Hi, welcome to the Growth.me summary of the book Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. Sapiens explains how we went from being simple primates 2.5 million years ago to walking on the moon today. Yuval Noah Harari explores the cognitive, agricultural, and scientific revolutions which made us who we are today. He also says common myths like money, laws, and nations are what hold human societies together. Our top quote from this book is, "Just 6 million years ago, a single female ape had two daughters. One became the ancestor of all chimpanzees, the other is our own grandmother." End quote. So who is Yuval Noah Harari? Well, he's a historian, philosopher, and professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. This book, Sapiens, was based on a series of his university lectures. Originally published in Hebrew, it was later translated to English in 2014 and became an international bestseller. Why is it so popular? Well, in this book, Sapiens, Harari covers 2.5 million years of human history, but it's not going to be a dry repetition of names and dates. Harari doesn't just tell us what happened, he also offers fascinating analysis about what historical events meant for humans living today. From the discovery of farming, to the invention of money, to the rise of monotheistic religions, to the scientific revolution, these all changed our lives in many ways you may not expect. So now let's dive into some of the biggest lessons from Sapiens. The first lesson is early humans were basically the same as other animals. 2.5 million years ago, the earliest humans lived in East Africa. They ate fruits and nuts, they hunted small animals, they formed relationships, they competed with each other for status. But the most important thing to know about those early humans is they were essentially the same as other animals. Now, over thousands of years, some humans went to Europe and Asia, and the different environments in those places caused many new species of humans to evolve. For example, there were Neanderthals in Europe and West Asia, there was Homo erectus in Eastern Asia, there was Homo saliensis around Indonesia, and there were ourselves, Homo sapiens, in East Africa, and many more species. What happened to all those other human species? Well, that's a dark secret that Harari will explore a little later. Now, all those early humans had far bigger brains than other animals. Early humans had brains 3 times bigger than similarly sized mammals, while modern humans have brains 6 times bigger than animals the same size as us. But those big brains came at a big cost. A big brain burns a lot of calories, so how did humans get all those calories to feed our brains? Many scientists believe through cooking with fire. You see, about 300,000 years ago, humans started using fire daily. This allowed them to eat new foods for the first time ever, like potatoes and grains, and these foods make up a lot of the calories people eat even today. Cooking also meant we spent far fewer hours chewing and digesting food than other animals. And after thousands of years of eating cooked foods, human jaws and teeth actually became smaller until they look like we do today. And by about 150,000 years ago, their human physical bodies were identical to modern humans. So, a summary of this first lesson. Although the earliest humans were not categorically different than other animals, our incredible brain growth, partly thanks to fire, set the foundation for our brains to grow and for us to become the complex thinking creatures we are today. And now we have lesson two. The cognitive revolution made Homo sapiens masters of the world. From about 70,000 years ago to 30,000 years ago, the mental abilities of Homo sapiens jumped past other animals. Harari calls this the cognitive revolution. During this time, humans began making advanced tools like boats, arrows, and sewing needles. They made cave paintings and created sculptures. They started worshipping religions and trading with each other. And most importantly, Homo sapiens began communicating with each other using language. Now, many animals communicate with each other in a basic way. They can make noises to get their mother's attention or to warn their herd of a predator nearby. But the language of Homo sapiens was on a totally new level. You see, language allowed Homo sapiens to create totally new strategies for survival, and it let us work together in complex, original ways. You see, the behavior of most animals is programmed in their DNA, in their instincts. For example, wolves can hunt, but only using relatively simple strategies. But ancient Homo sapiens could do totally new things, like chasing a whole herd of animals into tight valleys where they could easily slaughter them in large numbers. Scientists guess that human language began either as a way to pass on survival information or as a way to gossip. Survival information could include where to find food and water or where to watch out for a predator. And the gossip theory of scientists, it's not as far-fetched as it may sound at first. Even today, the majority of words found in magazines, news, or TV are about the actions or misbehavior of important people. Unfortunately, most details of the lives of those ancient humans are lost to us forever, but what do we know about them? Well, Yuval Noah Harari lists off some interesting facts. They probably lived in tribes of a few dozen to a few hundred people. They roamed around large areas of hundreds of kilometers searching for food, so they didn't have a permanent home. They rarely ran across members of other human tribes. They used tools, although most of those were made of wood, not stone, so they decomposed long ago. And they probably had some animistic religious beliefs, but we don't know their specific myths or rituals. In the end, Harari says there's a lot more we don't know about the lives and cultures of those early Homo sapiens than what we do know. Were they violent or peaceful? Well, different fossil collections tell different stories, so this probably depended on the local culture, just as today there are safe and dangerous places in the world. Now here's a spicy question. Were early Homo sapiens monogamous or not? Well, Harari says there isn't a clear answer, but in a different book called Behave, Stanford professor Robert Sapolsky offers one convincing explanation. Professor Sapolsky says when it comes to mating strategies, all primates have either a pair bonding or tournament strategy. Pair bonding primate species are mostly monogamous, and the males help to raise the kids after birth. On the other hand, tournament species are non-monogamous. In fact, only about 5% of the strongest males will mate with all the females, and they don't help raise the kids after birth. And you can actually tell what mating strategy a primate species has by looking at their sexual dimorphism, and that means how different the males and females of the species are. So in a pair-bonding primates, males and females look about the same, and they're about the same size, while in tournament primates, like gorillas, the males are much bigger than females, and they often look very different, because they evolved to compete with other males for mating rights. Well, if we look at human physical differences between the sexes, men are about 10% taller and 20% heavier than women. That suggests we are somewhere in between a pair bonding and tournament species. And that's probably why most human societies have been mostly monogamous. But there's almost always also been casual sex, infidelity, or polygamy in many places. If this little detour was interesting to you, then go check out our summary of the book Behave by Robert Sapolsky, where this little factoid comes from. So, in summary of this second lesson, 70,000 years ago, humans began using language to work together in complex new ways. This made us more effective than any other animal at working together, surviving, getting food. And humans also began making art and passing down cultural patterns and using more advanced tools like boats. Lesson 3. Homo sapiens probably wiped out the other human species. So what happened to those other human species like Neanderthals? I mean, today there are many types of pigs, rabbits, and dogs, for example, so why not multiple species of humans? Homo sapiens began spreading from East Africa to Europe and Asia around 70,000 years ago, and pretty soon after we arrived in a new place, the other human species in that area became extinct. And the fossil evidence is very suspicious and possibly incriminating for us Homo sapiens. There are multiple theories about what happened. One theory says Homo sapiens interbred with the other humans, eventually merging everyone into Homo sapiens. Now, about 1 to 5% of modern human DNA does come from other species like Neanderthals. But it's a very small percentage, which means that while some interbreeding did happen, it wasn't very common. Another theory says Homo sapiens outcompeted the other humans for food and other limited resources. With our bigger brains and better cooperation, we could gather food more effectively, leaving not enough for nearby human tribes to survive. And finally, there are theories that Homo sapiens exterminated the other species. And Yuval Noah Harari says this theory is entirely possible, considering how often even modern people have gone to war over minor differences in beliefs or skin color. In summary, whenever Homo sapiens arrived in a new part of the world, the other human species in that area, like Neanderthals, soon died out. We either outcompeted them for food or exterminated them in genocides. Some rare interbreeding took place also. Lesson 4. Ancient Homo sapiens caused mass extinctions every place they went. The world used to be covered with many giant animals called megafauna. There were 5-ton sloths, giant camels, and saber-toothed tigers in the Americas. There were wombats the size of hippopotamuses and oversized koalas in Australia. There were elephant birds twice as tall as a human in Madagascar. And then the Homo sapiens came. 45,000 years ago, Homo sapiens reached Australia, probably by boat from the Indonesian islands. A few thousand years later, 23 out of 24 Australian animal species weighing more than 50 kilograms had become extinct. And then 16,000 years ago, Homo sapiens came to the Americas, probably following reindeer and mammoths across a temporary ice bridge over the Arctic Ocean. And then within a couple thousand years, 34 out of 47 large animal species in North America became extinct. And then 50 out of 60 large species in South America also became extinct. And this pattern continues even to more recent times. 1,500 years ago, humans first came to the island of Madagascar, and pretty soon after, their giant lemurs and elephant birds disappeared. They were hunted out of existence. Again, 800 years ago, humans arrived in New Zealand for the first time, and you guessed it, their large animals vanished too very soon after. So, why did that happen? Well, the large animals in Africa, like elephants and rhinos, had evolved in contact with humans, so they have a healthy, natural caution toward us. But the large animals of other continents had never seen Homo sapiens before, so they didn't consider us a threat. I mean, we're a pretty small, weak-looking animal. And this means those animals were very easy to hunt. They're on the Galapagos Islands today, there are these giant tortoises which have no natural fear of humans. Well, that's how all the other ones of those large animals were in the past until Homo sapiens came and hunted them out of existence. So the uncomfortable truth is that humans have long been responsible for enormous environmental devastation, and that should probably wake us up to the effects we're having on the world today. Harari says large animals in the oceans right now are particularly vulnerable to being Homo sapiens' next victims because of overfishing and industrial pollution. In summary, Homo sapiens caused dozens of giant animal species to become extinct, including giant sloths, camels, and elephant birds. Soon after Homo sapiens arrived in a new continent or island, the big animals died out according to the fossils. Lesson 5. The agricultural revolution multiplied our population but lowered quality of life. For most of human existence, we fed ourselves through hunting wild animals and gathering wild plant foods like vegetables, fruits, nuts, etc. Then one day, this all started to change. Around 9500 BC, people living around the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea began growing their own foods. Natufian settlements in that area at that time were using mortars and pestles to grind grains into flour, and they even had stone granaries. This change from hunting, gathering, to farming was probably gradual. It happened over time. So first, ancient people only were gathering some wild grains for food, and then at some point they discovered they could help the grains grow better by pulling weeds, tilling soil, and bringing water. So that's what they did. And as they grew more and more grains, their lifestyles shifted. And the shift from hunting to raising one's own animals was probably similar. First, humans decided to protect a local herd from other predators. And then they decided to avoid killing the fertile females and young animals of that herd so that it could thrive. And eventually, those humans were spending most of their time shepherding and farming rather than finding animals and food in the wild. The agricultural population caused the human population to explode. 12,000 years ago, there were only several million humans around the world hunting and gathering, but by about 2,000 years ago, there were over 250 million humans farming. However, Harari calls the agricultural revolution history's biggest fraud, because although farming did allow humans to grow in population dramatically, it also led to a worse quality of life for the average person. Why? Well, first, worse health. Grains are poor in vitamins and very bad for our teeth and gums. While the diet of a hunter-gatherer had far more nutrition from a combination of meat, fish, fruits, vegetables, grasses, roots, nuts, and seeds. Second, there were famines. When most people became dependent on one or two staple agricultural crops, then a lack of rain or a new fungus could cause masses of people to starve, and that's what happened. And since hunter-gatherers had relied on a wider variety of foods, they were much less vulnerable to those kinds of problems. Third, diseases and plagues. Farming made people live closer together in larger villages and then cities, which encouraged the spread of sicknesses. Fourth, longer work hours. Modern hunter-gatherers, like those living in the Kalahari Desert, are only spent about 35 to 45 hours every week getting food. In fact, that's far less than most farmers did in the past and less time than many modern office workers work. So here's a quote from Sapiens. "This discrepancy between evolutionary success and individual suffering is perhaps the most important lesson we can draw from the agricultural revolution." End quote. Humans began farming because each individual step forward appeared to give them more food, but they could not foresee the longer-term future consequences of their actions. Having more food caused them to have more kids to work on the farm, and the kids ate the excess food. So in the end, it looked like most farmers worked harder and longer hours than their hunter-gatherer predecessors, and they had worse health. Today, we see the agricultural revolution as the foundation of the prosperity and security that most of the world enjoys, and that may be true today. However, for most of history, in the past few thousand years, agriculture looked very different. There were 12,000 years of peasants breaking their backs doing hard manual labor all day until we finally came to modern technology and automation. So, in summary, around the Mediterranean Sea, humans started growing crops and raising animals. Farming dramatically increased the human population. Yet, compared to hunter-gatherers, farmers had worse health, more famines, more disease, and longer working hours. Now, lesson 6. Belief in common myths allowed millions of strangers to cooperate. So, how are modern people able to create space stations and nuclear generators? Through the mass cooperation of millions of people, from miners to physicists to engineers to janitors, together we can accomplish feats far beyond the imagination of any other animal. And, okay, sure, a single human can make tools, but even chimpanzees use basic tools like twigs to fish termites out of the ground. So it's really our mass cooperation that sets us apart from the other animals. And that's why it was such an important revolution in human history that we began living together in large numbers. And it was common myths that made that possible. In prehistoric times, the largest villages contained a few hundred people at most. In 7000 BC, the largest city was probably Qetalhöyük, which had up to 10,000 people. But with agriculture, cities steadily grew in size, and by 1776 BC, Babylon was the world's largest city, containing tens of thousands of people, and it was part of the Babylonian Empire, which had more than a million people as subjects. Yuval Noah Harari says the belief in common myths like nations, laws, money, corporations, and gods are what allow large numbers of sapiens to live and work together. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to. The ancient Babylonian Empire was based on a system of laws called the Code of Hammurabi. This code consisted of about 300 rules created by one of the first Babylonian rulers named King Hammurabi. Many of the rules in that code were about punishments for specific crimes, and the punishments were different depending on the class of the perpetrator and the victim. Hammurabi's code divided society into three classes: superiors, commoners, and slaves. For example, if a superior man blinded the eye of another superior man, his own eye would be blinded, and this is where the expression "an eye for an eye" comes from. But if a superior man blinded the eye of a commoner, then he would only have to pay 60 shekels of silver as punishment. By modern standards, giving people different punishments based on their social class and gender doesn't feel very just. But the Code of Hammurabi brought order to the Babylonian Empire, and it continued to be copied down by scribes for generations after Hammurabi's death. At the beginning of Hammurabi's code is a very interesting statement that says that the top Mesopotamian gods, such as Marduk, personally appointed Hammurabi as ruler to bring justice to the land and, quote, prevent the strong from oppressing the weak, end quote. This is a common pattern in most societies even today. The fundamental myths are said to be based in some supernatural order, rather than simply being human-made, and that brings a sense of stability to the myths that hold up the social order. Of course, nobody today follows Hammurabi's code, and few people believe in Marduk, but are we really so much different today? The American Declaration of Independence begins by saying it is founded on, quote, nature's law and nature's God, end quote, and then it says, quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, end quote. Most modern people do believe in ideas like equality and human rights as sacred and eternal principles, but where did those ideas really come from? Harari says they were founded on Christian beliefs, like that every person has a soul created by God, and so we are all equal in front of God's judgment. I mean, certainly people are not equal or identical in any biological sense, because we are all born with different DNA and different natural talents. And you also won't find any discussion of human rights in a quantum physics textbook. Modern science says all animals, plants, and rocks are simply bouncing atoms, no human rights to be found there. So equality and human rights, Harari says, are imagined orders in exactly the same way Hammurabi's code was. But just to say they are imagined orders, that doesn't mean that they don't exist. When an imagined order exists in the minds of masses of people, then those orders have a real influence in the physical world, and they allow us to create orderly and successful societies. Here's a quote from the book. Imagined orders are not evil conspiracies or useless mirages. Rather, they are the only way large numbers of humans can cooperate effectively. End quote. In summary, mass cooperation is what fundamentally separates humans from other animals. By working together, we can create space stations and medicines. And what enables millions of people to live and work together are common myths, which is belief in things like money, laws, and nations. And now lesson 7. Money is a system of trust, one of the most valuable common myths. For most of human existence, people lived in small tribes where everyone was familiar with each other. So if your neighbor gave you their extra meat last week, then they assumed you would pay them back in the future somehow. Now, obviously, when people started living in larger settlements with many strangers nearby, this system no longer worked very well. And sometimes prehistoric people also bartered, which means they trading one item directly for another item, like my bag of apples for your boots. Bartering also has some big limitations, such as always needing to find someone who has what you want and wants what you have to offer. Can't always find the combination of those two. And then money was invented. Now, when most of us hear the word money, we probably imagine coins and paper bills, yet that's not what money really is. Money is simply whatever people use to systematically represent the value of other things. And many objects have been used as money in the past. For example, there was barley. Was used as money in Sumer around 3000 BC. This is actually the earliest known form of money. Ancient Sumerians bought and sold goods in exchange for cups of barley, which is a grain. People probably found it easier to accept barley as money in the beginning because it does have some inherent value. You can eat it. Another one was cowrie shells. They were used as money all over Africa and Asia for thousands of years. These small shells can be stored a lot more easily than grains because they don't rot or attract rats. And then gold and silver became the most popular form of money. These soft, shiny metals have no inherent value. They can't be eaten or turned into weapons, but they are far easier to store than cups of barley. And then coins started being used around 640 BC by King Aliyats of Lydia. Coins offered the benefit of standardized weights of gold or silver. They were also stamped with the mark of a king, which helped people trust the value of the coin more because everyone knew that counterfeiters would be severely punished by the king in power. And even today, we have virtual data. That's a form of money. Today, 90% of money only exists virtually inside of computer servers. That really doesn't change its fundamental nature because money is simply a system of mutual trust rather than specific objects. So here's a quote from Sapiens. Cowrie shells and dollars have value only in our common imagination. Their worth is not inherent in the chemical structure of the shells or paper, or their color or their shape. In other words, money isn't a material reality, it is a psychological construct. End quote. Money connected total strangers around the world, allowing them to trade even without pre-existing trust. And we're often blind to how deeply commerce and international trade has shaped our cultures. For example, tomatoes are often considered a staple of Italian cooking, but they only arrived in Europe for the first time 400 years ago from the Americas. That's also true for potatoes, which are often considered the most essential staple of Irish and Polish cooking. In summary, money is not coins or paper bills, but an incredibly useful common myth. Throughout history, people have used many forms of money, including barley, seashells, gold, coins, and virtual numbers. The dollars of a country have value only because everyone agrees to accept them in exchange for their labor or goods. And now we have lesson 8. Empires oppressed people, but also unified them. Several thousand years ago, most humans lived in small cultural bubbles, barely aware of the existence of other cultures or other peoples. Yet today, the world is becoming more and more of a single global culture. To a great degree, empires caused this change to happen over the past 4,000 years. An empire is a political order that rules over at least several different distinct cultural groups, and it can flexibly expand its borders to swallow more groups. That's the two-part definition from Yuval Noah Harari. The first empire was probably the Akkadian Empire of Sargon the Great, which happened around 2250 BC. Over a few decades, King Sargon went from being king of one small city-state to the ruler of all the other Mesopotamian city-states, an area that covers most of Iraq and Syria today. Then, around 500 BC, a much larger Persian Empire was founded by Cyrus the Great. This Persian Empire was fundamentally different than previous empires because Cyrus claimed he was conquering new people for their own benefit. So he created the idea of a benevolent ruler, a benevolent empire, a template which was copied by most empires that followed. And from that point on, empires usually justified their expansion by claiming they were spreading a more advanced culture throughout the world in the form of laws, writing, money, arts, religions, etc. In empires, the ruled and the ruling people sometimes merged into one group. For example, the Roman Empire conquered many foreign cultures, but over generations, those foreigners became more and more Roman until eventually they were granted Roman citizenship. In fact, many of the last Roman emperors actually had a non-Roman ethnic origin. The Han Empire, which ruled China around 2,000 years ago, also assimilated many, many separate cultural groups into one. They were so successful that today 90% of people in China define themselves as Han, ethnically. Today, empires and imperialism are often viewed very negatively. Some people say all traces of past imperialism should be removed to reclaim a nation's authentic culture. Now, on the one hand, it is true that past empires were often brutal, tyrannical, committing slavery, war, and genocide. But Harari says they also shaped many positive aspects of modern countries. They contributed arts, culture, development, and more. For example, a few Indian people today would want to rid their country of many British imports like tea, railway systems, the English language, and Western-style democracy. And even before the British arrived, the Mughal Empire had made its mark on India. It ruled India for hundreds of years, demanding peasants pay up to half their labor in taxes, but also leaving behind cultural treasures like the Taj Mahal. So even if you get rid of one past empire, you'll probably be left with the legacies of previous empires. In summary, an empire is a political order that can flexibly expand its borders, swallowing more and more groups of people. Empires spread standardized languages, laws, and religions, and more, leading to more global connectedness. Now lesson 9. The scientific revolution, driven by imperialism, created a world of constant progress. The basic principles of science are admitting that we don't know everything and that we can learn new things through observation. Today, we take these fundamental ideas of science for granted so much that we don't realize how revolutionary they were at the time. For most of human history, people were not interested in discovering new knowledge. People generally assumed that past scriptures contained all the knowledge that was worth knowing, so the best they could do was study those old teachings and pass them on. Then, around 500 years ago, scientific discoveries began reshaping our world at a speed never before seen, giving Homo sapiens incredible new technologies and powers. And that's why the human population exploded from 500 million to 8 billion in the past 500 years. Imagine a peasant from the Middle Ages waking up today to smartphones, skyscrapers, space stations, and modern medicine. They would be totally bewildered. So what drove the incredible scientific progress? Well, the answer may surprise you. You see, science can be expensive. Scientists need laboratories, telescopes, chemicals, equipment, they need to travel, etc. Who provides those resources? Usually governments and businesses. And they choose to fund the scientific projects which will hopefully help them reach their political, economic, or military goals. In many of the earliest expeditions to the New World, ships contained scientists making observations, as well as soldiers looking for gold and other resources. So you cannot really separate the scientific goals from their imperial and military goals, which often funded the whole expedition. For example, in 1768, the famous James Cook expedition led to the European discovery of Australia and New Zealand, lands which Cook quickly claimed for the British Empire. The expedition originally started out with the goal to make an astronomical observation about Venus from the island of Tahiti. Yet without the potential military payoff, the scientific part of the expedition would never have been funded. Another big discovery on that expedition was that eating fruits and vegetables would stop sailors from dying of a sickness called scurvy. That life-saving medical insight helped the British Navy rule the seas for a long time after. Here's another example. In 1831, the British Royal Navy sent a ship to explore the coasts of South America to create military maps. Along for the ride was a recent Cambridge University graduate named Charles Darwin. His observations on that trip led to the theory of evolution. In summary, in the past 500 years, science has changed human societies beyond recognition. Many of the earliest overseas expeditions contained both scientists like Charles Darwin, as well as soldiers pursuing military goals. It's difficult to separate the science from the political, economic, and imperial goals which funded it. Now, lesson 10. Modern states and markets allow for individualism, but at the cost of community. Until very recently, your family and your local community were all important. They were your social security net, your health insurance, your retirement plan in the form of kids, and more. So a couple hundred years ago, if you were banished from your family or local community, then to survive, you may have needed to go into slavery or worse. Today, the state and the market are taking over many of the old roles of family and community. Governments provide social security, pension plans, healthcare, and more now. Private markets provide services like daycare for kids and caretakers for aging parents. On the one hand, this change gives us more individual freedom than ever. Most of us no longer need the approval of our parents about who to marry, where to live, or what career to pursue. We can go and find a community of people to be a part of, rather than needing to fit into whatever village we happen to be born in. And yet today, many modern people are left feeling alone and estranged by our increasing reliance on states and markets. You see, humans, having evolved for thousands of years in tightly knit tribes, perhaps we do feel happier belonging to a community rather than as a disconnected, autonomous individual. So today we are free to choose who we associate with or marry, but that also means they are free to leave us or divorce us. However, even our needs for emotional bonding are now being fulfilled more and more by markets. For example, many people today find community by belonging to consumer tribes, like being fans of the same music artists or sports teams. And so we buy posters, clothing, or event tickets to be part of a tribe. In summary, today we rely less on our families and local communities than at any point in human history, and more on the state and market to provide things for us, like security. That means we have more individual freedom than before, but also are missing maybe some feeling of belonging to a tightly knit community. Now, lesson 11. Did all this progress improve human happiness, and what lies ahead? Yuval Noah Harari ends this book on a more philosophical tone. He says historians don't often ask questions about the effects of historical events. But we should. And the most important question may be, has all this material progress made Homo sapiens any happier? At first glance, many of us would say yes. I mean, who'd want to go back to the time of being a peasant in the Middle Ages or someone being chased by lions in ancient Africa? But Harari says the answer may not be so simple for three reasons. First, people are generally very bad at guessing what will make them happy. So, for example, studies find that both people who experience something very positive, like winning the lottery, and very negative, like being an amputee, they only feel different for a short time. After a year, people in those situations return to a level of happiness about the same as everyone else's. Second, happiness may be more about our expectations than about what we actually have. So modern people have air conditioners, daily showers if they want to, and airplanes. But these don't make us wildly happy every day. In fact, more people take antidepressants than ever. So we've come to expect those modern conveniences, which means they don't lead to happiness. In the same way, people in the past who lived in more poverty, more hardship, and filth, well, they may not have really noticed their poor conditions because that's what they expected. And third, happiness may be more about meaning than about comfortable conditions. The psychologist Daniel Kahneman found that the daily work that comes with being a parent is rated by most people to be very unpleasant, like the work of changing a diaper and calming down temper tantrums. However, parents also usually rate their kids as their greatest source of joy and happiness. Well, although the work of being a parent isn't fun, it is deeply meaningful. It's done for a meaningful reason in the end. And by the way, here's a connection to a related book. The psychologist Viktor Frankl survived the concentration camps of World War II, and he saw that the prisoners who survived those camps were the ones who could find a source of meaning in the middle of their terrible suffering. Those who couldn't find meaning eventually gave up and lost their lives. Viktor Frankl says the three main sources of meaning in life are, one, through work, which is doing or creating something significant, two, through love, which is relating and caring for others, and three, through facing suffering with courage when it's unavoidable. And if you want some deep insights into finding how to find meaning in your own life, then go read our summary of Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which can be found at growth.me. I highly recommend that one. That's Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. So back to Sapiens. If meaning is the most important part of life that makes it worth living, then modern people could be worse off than our ancestors. Many studies show that people feel their close relationships are the most meaningful part of life, and that means the modern trends of weaker family cohesion and rising divorce rates may be leading to less happiness than before, despite us having more comfortable living conditions. Religion is also on the decline in many Western countries, and this was a major source of meaning for people throughout history. A peasant living in the Middle Ages may have had a very hard life, but they could look forward to eternal life in heaven with the Creator at the end of it, which could have made all that suffering meaningful. Meanwhile, a modern secular person may have a lot more comfort and security now, but they can look forward only to slow physical disintegration at the end of their life, followed by nothing. You know, if you're sitting in the middle of paradise, but you feel empty and useless, then I don't think it's possible to be happy. So while we're still thinking about whether history was worth it at all, it's a little bit depressing, Harari offers also some guesses about what the future may bring for humans. Well, for example, scientists can already genetically engineer worms to live longer. They can make mice be smarter, and they can make voles be monogamous. So that's a different type of small animal. So if those changes can be brought to humans eventually, and there's no reason to believe they can't, then at some point in the future, Homo sapiens, we may be unrecognizable from what we are today. And that may be the end of Homo sapiens as we know it. So in summary, modern people are very comfortable and secure, but does that mean we're any happier? People now get used to new conveniences, quickly taking them for granted, and most people in history found meaning in life through family, marriage, close relationships, religion, things like that, which are now less stable than in the past. Okay, so in conclusion, hope you enjoyed this summary of Sapiens. And if you found this interesting, definitely go read the full book, which contains tons more detail that we didn't have time to touch in this summary. And I'll see you in our next book summary.